Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. In this special extended edition of the AQ Podcast, an interview with the White House's point man on Latin America, Juan Gonzalez.
When we came in January, we knew that given the crises the region was facing, we could not divide the region into those who were with us and those who were against us. And so we've sought common ground with all democratically elected governments.
The common lament is that Washington doesn't pay enough attention to Latin America. But that has not been the case so far, 8 months into the Joe Biden administration, in part because Latin America has been impossible to ignore, with several crises that have been front page headlines around the world, including here in the United States. And, you know, really, it's been one thing after another. The migration crisis on the U.S. southern border, disagreements with Brazil over the Amazon, new talks between the Maduro regime and Venezuela's opposition, IMF negotiations with Argentina, the assassination of the president of Haiti, and the growing competition over influence in the Western Hemisphere with China. I could go on, but I won't. At the center of it all, our guest today, Juan Gonzalez. Juan is President Joe Biden's top aide on Latin America. His formal title is the Senior Director for the Western Hemisphere at the National Security Council. He also held important positions in the Obama administration. He's a friend who first appeared on the AQ podcast in 2020, has written for America's Quarterly as well. Today, on this special issue of the AQ podcast, we'll do a full tour of Latin America, hear Juan's viewpoints, and challenge him on a few issues as well. Juan, welcome back to the AQ podcast.
Brian, thanks for having me. I got exhausted just hearing you list off everything that's going on, but I wanted to start out by saying that I really admire the work that all of you all are doing at America's Quarterly. I never miss a podcast. I listen to it on my bike rides into the office. But I think it's just incredibly important to have the strategic analysis of the region that you all are offering, particularly at a time when there's so much going on.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. Thank you. So, Juan, you know, this exhausting intro that I just gave, why do you think the last 8 months have been so busy in terms of just the flow of news and often crises out of Latin America? Do you have a theory as to what's happening right now that has made this such a busy period?
It's a great question. Part of it is the byproduct of 4 years of a policy that looked at two countries and really didn't think strategically about the region. But I think more importantly,
What were those two countries?
Well, Cuba and Venezuela, as really the defining characteristics of U.S. relationship with Latin America. I think that's an approach that maybe would have been more apt for the 1980s than today, when you have a region that is much more global and really fits into the conversation of geopolitics and what has been a changing dynamic around the world. But I think that's the second reason, which is that the region's trends are negative, regardless of what you're looking at, whether it's democracy, the size of the middle class, the security situation. You can blame the pandemic, and certainly the pandemic has created a once in a century economic crisis. But the structural weaknesses that the hemisphere had existed well before. We saw those in the protests in Chile and Colombia and other places, where you had the demands of the people of the region really exceeding the capabilities of the countries of the region. Just one other point on this is, you particularly if you look at how economies have been measured and how progress has been measured in terms of GDP growth. Overseas development assistance is really targeted low-income countries and poverty reduction. When you look at Latin America, it doesn't fit neatly into these constructs of how we do foreign assistance or how we would measure economic progress. GDP growth in Latin America has been accompanied by increased inequality and increased violence, and a lot of that really has to do with governance, with some notable exceptions. And so that is a space where China, Russia thrive, And, you know, but it's also a place that leads to greater instability. And so we came in and had a series of crises. We expected them, but didn't expect them all at the same time. And so we've been pretty hard at work. I got to say, though, as somebody who has worked in the U.S. government and different departments and agencies over about 20 years now, you know, I've been working with the president for several years, but really it's been the career people at the State Department, you know, DOD, other departments and agencies that I've been able to lean on through all this. I guess Ricardo Zuniga is no stranger to you all. He's probably the most talented diplomat of his generation. We finally have Brian Nichols as the assistant secretary, but just the career diplomats are the ones that were enthusiastically diving into an effort to try to take a strategic approach to the region. It's been really great to be back and to be working with them.
Well, and it's been a challenge, as you said, and it's been a tough year, I think, for the whole world. To your point about the pandemic in particular generating so much tumult, there is a case to be made that Latin America has really been ground zero, having accounted for 25% of the world's COVID-19 deaths, despite only accounting for 8% of its population. The 7% contraction that we saw regionally in Latin America's economies, again, on average, in 2020 was the biggest fall anywhere, with the possible exception of the European Union. So yeah, it was a rough year following a rough decade, as you mentioned. But, you know, there's the health crisis, there's the economic crisis. But what I really wanted to talk about first was, and you mentioned it, this erosion of democracy that we're seeing throughout so much of Latin America and really throughout the West. I mean, it's a subject of great concern for many of us, something I write about a lot. We've seen rising authoritarianism in Nicaragua to a lesser but still worrying degree in places like El Salvador and Brazil. Some say Mexico, you know, is worrying on this front as well. How are you approaching this issue, this democratic erosion, from your position at the White House? And is it more difficult, given what happened in the United States in late 2020 and early 2021? I mean, does Washington still have any moral authority to talk to other countries about democracy?
That's a great question. And as somebody actually accompanied, as the NSC, they always put an NSC person on the president's motorcade the day of the inauguration, I was honored to be asked to accompany the president-elect and to walk through the U.S. Capitol just days after the events of January 6th. Was really shocking. I think all of us that were part of that group at points cried, because you just don't imagine that happening in the United States. And an image I'll never forget is at the end of the ceremonies, when they're about to walk out of the Capitol, President, the First Lady, the Vice President, and Senate Majority Leader, Speaker, you see them standing out there in silence as they're waiting for the doors to open, and there's this giant crack on the window, the main door of the Capitol. I wish I had a camera, and it just, I think it was an important symbol that, you know, democracy is something that you can't take for granted. You have to keep working to maintain it. Does it undermine our credibility? I think to the contrary, it allows us to speak on the same footing with some of these countries. But it also informs our approach to the region, that we can engage these governments. But we also have to engage civil society. We have to engage the private sectors, because they're more than just government actors here. I'll say that Central America is probably the where a lot of this comes together, right? You have a region that, after the Cold War, we basically said, great, we're going to leave. The market is going to take care of everything. So good luck in your senior year. And didn't really, you know, there were no institutions that guaranteed access to justice, that, you know, allowed systems to develop. And you have what a quota that's off, that, you know, I've been quoted often as describing a predatory elite in Central America as ones that really the status quo of not actually investing in the state, having migration as a relief valve, and then sets remittances that drive consumption as a as an economic model, and one where you're seeing this counterattack against the anti-corruption forces that have taken place since Obama and Biden left office, has been something that has left us in a hole. And what I got to say is that we have these overarching objectives in Central America, something where Ricardo is just really knowledgeable and we've talked about a lot. We're focused on reinforcing democratic governance and generating opportunities and improving security for the people of Central America so they can build successful lives. But all of that revolves around matters of governance and corruption. And you know, early on when we came in, some analysts would write about how the United States would have to choose between corruption and migration. Now those same analysts are saying that we have to focus on corruption because of China. But I think at the end of the day, we really can't compromise on matters of corruption, because corruption is a driver of migration. Corruption is an environment in which countries like China thrive and Russia thrive. It is the root cause of migration from the region. And it's the reason that you have incredibly unequal societies in Central America. And I'll say, without going on too long, the vice president's approach to root causes, where she looked at what then Vice President Biden did in Central America, kept what worked when he was leading the effort, but also added her own signature to it. It has been recognizing that the government can't fix these problems. The U.S. government can't fix these problems, particularly if there's no political will in the region. But number two, you can't just use sanctions and indictments and visa suspensions to change what is a longstanding institutional dynamic. You have to expand the number of allies. So she's been talking to the private sector. She has a economic financial initiative for Central America, where you have a profit proposition to anti-corruption efforts. She's been talking to, every time Jake, the president, talks to a foreign leader, the vice president has made clear that we need to be talking about the importance of Central America. So it's part of our international engagement, but then talking to foundations as well, and obviously engaging with civil society. So we have a broad coalition of governments and other actors that are united behind the task of combating corruption and promoting greater opportunity, greater transparency, to create an environment where people don't want to leave Guatemala for the United States.
Yeah. But so let's talk about this anti-corruption push for a moment, because it is clear that, particularly with regard to the Northern Triangle, the Biden administration has tried to put this front and center with the countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. But on the other hand, it doesn't really seem like those countries are listening. You know, the most daring move, but not the only example of this kind of tactic, was the Guatemalan Attorney General's decision to remove Juan Francisco Sandoval, an internationally renowned anti-corruption prosecutor, just weeks after Vice President Harris was there and recognized his role explicitly. So, I mean, I think all of us understand the importance of this anti-corruption topic and how it holds back development and so on. But how do you explain the fact that these governments really seem to be not only resisting, but actively pushing back?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a lot of these governments, there is corruption as a system of government. There's not a democracy or a autocracy. They're functioning, highly functioning corrupt systems at play. And it's something actually Ricardo Zuniga said at a recent Atlantic Council event, that the argument that the executive and the judicial branch are separate and that we have to respect judicial independence, that really doesn't apply. There's definitely executive maneuvering behind the scenes and legislative maneuvering behind the scenes behind what the Attorney General did in Guatemala. What is the response? You know, so I always say that you can't, siege tactics won't take every castle. In some cases, you want to take a very public approach to make a very clear point. And in that regard, you know, we are going to use the anti-corruption task force that the president promised during the campaign trail to help governments protect public resources and you know, and go after corrupt officials. But we're also going to use our financial system to protect it from money laundering and other crimes stemming from corruption. We're not going to compromise on corruption. We've been doing that since the 80s to embrace people that were leaders that agreed with us. This is about really pressing. And it's something that is not going to be transformational over time, particularly after the last 4 years of really not thinking about combating corruption. It's going to take time to change these societies or to create the environment under which these societies will create a space for transparency and for democratic actors to try to, you know, I think, change the rules of the game. You know, countries like Guatemala, the largest economy in Central America, I mean, in the Northern Triangle countries, can be so much more economically. But, you know, corruption also favors the status quo. And you look at not just Central America, but the region overall, we have some time, but not a lot of time, to address what are some major changes or to adapt to some major changes that are underway in the world. It's global industrial transformation taking place of a region that is remains dependent on fossil fuels. When we're going through a global energy transition, you're having a shifting of supply chains. And I think when in the 4 years I was in the private sector, when you talk about Central America, a Fortune 100 or 500 company is not as interested in Central America because they're small markets and they're too high risk. So there's not a trade solution to the challenges of Central America. There's an integration and a transparency and a governance challenge that, if addressed, can help countries in Central America adapt. I mean, jumping around, if you look at, you know, the crises that we've been dealing with, right? You have Haiti, you have Cuba, and you have other countries. Each is a test case in how governments respond to popular mobilization or to crisis. In Haiti, you've had a complete breakdown of the state. They're asking for our help, but they, you know, there was 40% food insecurity even before the earthquake, and a very kind of corrupt and dysfunctional political system. What we've been trying to do there is support Haitian solutions to Haitian challenges, really try to not have a short-term perspective to Haiti. In Cuba, the response to the demands of people that just wanted greater freedoms was crackdowns, summary judgments, a very oppressive and controlling state. I think the exception, I think perhaps the model, has been really Chile. Again, no surprise, is that you know, after the protests that they saw in 2019, rather than sending the military into the streets or you know, blaming others for the challenges, they created an institutional mechanism by which the people of Chile could engage in these debates and find a way forward, and they voted to reform the Pinochet-era constitution. In May, of course, there were some concerns about the leaders that were elected to the Constitutional Assembly, but things are moving in a constructive direction in Chile because they are creating the mechanisms and the institutions for the people to actually have a voice and shape the political culture and society.
Before we leave the Northern Triangle topic aside, let me just ask you one more question about this one. You know, I wrote for a piece for AQ back in June. The Central American governments now seem more comfortable ignoring or openly defying Washington than any time I can remember. And there's this added dynamic now, which you mentioned, which is, you know, been articulated out loud by, especially by El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele. He hasn't said this exactly, but the subtext is often, well, if I'm not getting along, if Washington is not going to, you know, if Washington's going to take a hard line on this, then I've got these other guys I can work with, which is the Chinese. I mean, is there a risk of pushing so hard on this anti-corruption front that the United States ends up pushing these countries further into the orbit of Beijing, or risks losing their cooperation on issues like migration?
Well, I think definitely we have to recognize that these are incredibly complex challenges and relationships that we're managing. With the exception of Nicaragua, we are trying to find positive agendas. You know, Jean Mains, our ambassador that served in El Salvador, we sent her back. She had a relationship with Bukele to try to engage constructively with him. We're trying to engage constructively with the governments, but we're making very clear that we're not compromising on the fight against corruption. Will that send them into the arms of China? I do not think so, because we are the most important economic actors and political actors in these countries. And what we don't want to do is bring down economies, because that's just not it won't serve anybody's interest. But actually, to recognize that these sorts of efforts take time, that political fortunes and popularity shift over time as well, and that we can be persistent, constructive, and try to move the countries in a direction where, where they're embracing transparency. China is not going to come in and save El Salvador. It's just not. It may try to capitalize by trying to get access or long lease on a port, and that's something that the El Salvadoran people would have to engage in a debate about. Seeing examples in Sri Lanka that have not served that country's interests. But when it comes to the economies of these countries, the U.S. remains the dominant political sphere, and frankly, the people of these countries are very much aligned with the anti-corruption era, because they are sick and tired of governments that just aren't responding and aren't investing in their own people.
Juan, I wish I could follow up this difficult discussion on Northern Triangle with an easy topic, just to give you a breather. But unfortunately, it's such a long list of thorny issues here. So let me just go on to the next one, which is Venezuela. You know, we've seen a first round of talks now between the Nicolas Maduro regime and the opposition. What are your expectations for what can be accomplished in these talks? Do you see any chance that Maduro negotiates terms for his exit from power and a return to democracy in Venezuela? And if not, is there any point to these discussions?
That's a great question. I'll preface that by saying that, you know, I've been working on Venezuela for a very long time. I was actually the director for the Andean region when Chavez passed, and you know, so I've been engaged in this conversation even before then. So I think it's important to mention that I have seen past efforts at negotiations fail, and I know why they fail. I think clear-eyed about the regime's intentions to negotiate partial agreements to try to undermine those Venezuelans who want democracy, so that they can gain some sort of legitimacy and approach normalization directly with the United States. Our approach to Venezuela has been consistent. We've actually been public in that approach to make very clear and leave no room to misunderstandings that we are in favor of negotiations that lead to a free and fair elections, and that U.S. policy will respond to concrete actions in that direction. And that approach has allowed us to rebuild a coalition that includes the European Union and several countries of Latin America and the Caribbean along those along that objective. I think while the peaceful restoration of democratic order and a sustainable economic growth of Venezuela is something that is undeniably in the interest of the United States, at best, it is a long-term proposition, and I think the chances of success are low. That doesn't mean that the negotiations are not worthwhile. I think when you have a clear conversation where on one side of the table are Venezuelans who want democracy, and on the other side of the table, Venezuelans who do not, that is something that allows the international community to organize itself around those Venezuelans that really want a positive future for their country. But our approach has been to expand this international consensus along humanitarian questions. We've been very successful at that. And then if the talks succeed, but especially if they fail, as an international community, create very clear expectations about what the expectations are. Whether or not there are negotiations, the expectations of the United States are going to be the same. But we've made very clear that the way for any sort of change to happen in U.S. policy is through negotiations that lead to compromise and democratic order, so that all political actors, including Chavistas, are able to compete for power in a transparent, free, and fair process. But we recognize that's something that's going to take time. So the other area has been a focus on managing the externalities of the situation in Venezuela. So we've of the 110 million vaccines that have been shared with the world, over 40 million of those we've shared with Latin America and the Caribbean. We've expanded the amount that we've shared with Colombia so that they can start vaccination campaigns for Venezuelan refugees. And we've tried, you know, public and private messages to provide humanitarian support in any way possible.
So what I'm hearing is, yes, these negotiations may end up having some positive effects on kind of the humanitarian question, but you're not expecting like a big transition towards democracy to come as a result. Is it safe to say that the U.S. is kind of sitting out these negotiations at the moment?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, so we're putting all our energy into these negotiations, even though past being prologue, they've failed in the past, so I think we have to be realistic about this. But a lot of this really came about when interim President Juan Guaido, in May 11th, laid out a path toward a comprehensive agreement and signaled his willingness to support the lifting of sanctions based on concrete progress. That's been our approach. And we have, you know, I'll say I've kind of closed off access to the White House on Venezuela, because I think one of the mistakes the previous administration did was that there was one message coming from the State Department, there was one message coming from the White House that was contradictory. Here, the State Department is firmly in the lead, the diplomacy is in the lead. Ambassador Jimmy Story has been our main person. Now that Brian Nichols has been confirmed, he's going to be playing a very active role. And they talked to you know, a broad set of Venezuelans, those who want democracy and are looking for ways to be supportive. If we lift sanctions, again, it'll be based on concrete progress, but it's also based on conversations that we have with the Unity platform, who, to be honest, we are a main part of any leverage that they have in negotiations, and we're making very clear that we are on their side, which is the side of Venezuelans who want democracy.
Juan, let me mix in some more philosophical questions with these country-specific questions. You know, I noticed the recent decision by Mexico to decriminalize recreational use of marijuana. That, of course, follows legalization by several U.S. states. And I've seen some recent comments attributed to you essentially agreeing with the López Obrador government's criticism of the Mérida Initiative, which is, you know, the longtime kind of framework for the quote-unquote drug war in Mexico. My question, this is a big question, you know, is the drug war of the last 50 years slowly coming to an end? And more to the point, is what we're asking of other countries in the Western Hemisphere changing right now?
Well, you know, the debate in the United States about state-level legalization can't really speak to that and the administration's perspective to that. That's something that is a kind of state-by-state conversation. When it comes to U.S. counter-narcotics policy, you may recall I was on a bipartisan Western Hemisphere Drug Policy Commission that was established by legislation led by then Chairman Elliot Engel. And we looked at the Mérida Initiative, Plan Colombia, and our approach in other parts of Latin America and the Caribbean. And there's an important realization when you look at the history of U.S. Counter-narcotics policy is that strategies need to evolve over time. So the drug war is attributed to Nixon, but even when, you know, the days of Bill Brownfield, Roberta Jacobson, and others that have worked on this, those strategies have changed, and they haven't been what some people would characterize as a traditional supply-side policy. But when you look specifically at Mexico, and I led a team into Mexico in May to talk about how we could rebuild and restore the law enforcement relationship after it broke down in the previous administration. And if you go to Mexico, you have to look at this issue from the perspective of the Mexicans. If you're a Mexican that lives in a northern Mexico state, Ciudad Juarez, then for you, the drug problem is one of demand of drugs from the United States and the trafficking of weapons down. And unless the United States is willing to actually invest political capital in addressing those issues, it's disingenuous for the United States to really focus any counter-narcotic strategy focusing exclusively on what Mexico needs to do. And so the conversations that we've had with Mexico are ones where we start by saying this is a shared problem. and where we have responsibilities. This administration has made multi-billion-dollar investments in demand reduction. You have a president of the United States that is senator, was the first one who successfully took on the NRA implement a ban on assault weapons, and is somebody who's committed on addressing weapons used for violence, and particularly ghost weapons. This gives us a platform upon which to have a constructive conversation with Mexico on this. But at the same time, you know, I think the conversations we've had with the Foreign Minister Ebrard, the ambassador, and obviously we're incredibly fortunate to have Ambassador Ken Zelizar down there, is yes, lack of economic opportunity is a huge part of why people get into criminality. But at the same time, you have criminal organizations that are taking advantage. You have fentanyl, which is an emerging and very, very serious threat to the United States, but also the stability of Mexico and to the region. You have to go after the bad guys. So you have to, but we have to do it creatively, strategically, do high value target strategies against cartels work. I think you can question whether that approach works, but you have to find more strategic ways to go after criminal organizations that are not just involved in drugs, they're involved in the trafficking of people. They're involved in, you know, in Colombia, illegal mining is one that has been brought a lot of proceeds to criminal organizations. You have to look at making sure that you're helping establish a presence of the state, going after the financial crimes, go after the entire supply chain in a much more strategic way. There's a great book by a writer for The Economist called Narcoeconomics. There's a great chapter on how it's important to treat the drug trade like by looking at the value chain and treating it like a business. And it's one thing to spray coca, but if you really want to dismantle these organizations, you have to be strategic and you have to go after them in a much more strategic way. And I think that's what we're seeking to do with Mexico, but also like Mexico is a sovereign country, right? So they elected President López Obrador. He gets to determine the priorities of his administration. What we're looking to do is find a channel and a mechanism where we can sit down and have conversations about these sorts of issues. That's why we had the high-level economic dialogue last week. We're working on a high-level strategic security dialogue. We've been engaging with them on migration since the transition. And all of it has been based on a kind of reservoir of goodwill upon which we can address differences and find areas of collaboration. And that's, I think, ultimately how you really lay out a strategic vision for U.S.-Mexico cooperation that really is not, that doesn't come easy to the United States, because often the United States looks at Mexico from the perspective of the border and migration and security. It doesn't see always a strategic opportunity that is in a U.S.-Mexico economic and security relationship in a kind of global context.
One quick question, just in follow-up about the overall relationship with Mexico. You know, on the one hand, there have been some sticking points. López Obrador was very late to recognize President Biden's victory back at the end of 2020. There was this whole controversy back in January where the attorney general decided to drop a drug trafficking case that had been brought by U.S. prosecutors against General Salvador Cienfuegos, which some people saw as a massive breach of rule of law. But on the other hand, there's been this dialogue that you're describing, several conversations between President Biden and President López Obrador. I mean, overall, would you say the relationship with Mexico is in good shape?
Yes. I mean, I think the migration issues dominate our engagement with Mexico, or at least the front pages. We have core interests that go beyond that to meet, as I mentioned, the economic and security relationship, as well as our deep stake in Mexico's stability. And that's why the president, I'd love to take credit, but it was President Joe Biden who made the decision to share vaccines with Mexico and with Canada before anybody else, because he recognizes the importance of North America. Mexico, again, we have a complicated history appearing to disrespect Mexico's sovereignty or stretching that relation beyond the reasonable is something that can undermine that relationship, and it can backfire on us. So we have to treat them as partners and as equals to work on what have been some really tough issues. And we've been very constructive. I'll say that we are cooperating more with Mexico now by taking a constructive approach than when Trump threatened to impose tariffs and close down the border. And that, to me, is a huge measure of success.
You still hear whispers that maybe Lopez Obrador was more comfortable with Trump than with Biden. Do you think that's true?
I can't speak to that. What I do know is that, the two leaders had a very good conversation, President Biden and President Lopez Obrador. Vice President Harris and President Lopez Obrador spoke alone for over an hour and just really hit it off. And then when Jake Sullivan and I were there a couple of weeks ago, we spent 2 hours with Lopez Obrador and Ebrard talking about a lot of issues, and everything was incredibly constructive. As somebody who has been working on Mexico as long as veterans like Roberta Jacobson, I've never seen a relationship that is that constructive. And it's based on the premise that we need each other. Mexico needs us and we need them. And as the president said in their first virtual meeting, we do better when we invest in each other.
Juan, let's talk about another easy topic, China. there's an overall impression that you hear in some quarters that Beijing is kind of eating Washington's lunch right now in the region. Just one specific example of this, there was an announcement last week in Uruguay where, a conservative government announced that it was exploring trade talks with Beijing. And the president there has spoken of his desire to make Uruguay kind of a portal for Beijing in South America. How do you think we stand? How does the United States stand right now in terms of this race for influence in the Western Hemisphere? Do you think that this is kind of parallels the Cold War in some ways? Are we seeing a return to patterns of the 20th century, or is this different this time?
Yes. What I will tell you is that as somebody who was in the White House under Obama, Biden, and then, outside of government, and now that I'm back, the presence of Russia and China is concerning. And it's concerning because I think when you look at what China is doing in Latin America, you have to look at what has been this, strategy that has global designs to it. There's the economic and commercial relationships that China has advanced with Latin America, where they started kind of its Africa model of going after protein and fuel, and they've become more sophisticated. But elements of global military expansion, particularly the expansion of potential bases around the world, technology that is seen for research purposes, but it really has a dual use implication. There's surveillance technology that China is really kind of propagating around the world. And frankly, statements that you've seen by Xi Jinping, where he has made very clear that the Chinese model authoritarian capitalism is superior to the West model, is I think a direct threat to this hemispheric consensus that exists in favor of democracy. The question is, what do we do about it? And I think that we start on the basis that over the last 42 plus years of normalization between the United States and China, we have gone between collaboration, confrontation, and competition. We have a very active economic relationship with China. The biggest change we have made from the previous administration is that we're not going to ask countries to choose. They have the right to choose their economic relationships and their diplomatic relationships. We're not going to force countries to choose. The second one is we're not going to fight something with nothing. And so when you look at the issue of Huawei, wagging your finger at Chile or Brazil or Mexico, when 5G and the IoT technology is something that is going to have billions in development potential for the region, you have to develop an alternative. And so we've sought to do that. It's not that, without going off on a tangent, it's not that the market is not working when it comes to 5G. It's that we don't like who the winner is. And there's an oligopoly where China is just much more effective at competing. But there are obviously government-led alternatives, and then there are private sector-led alternatives. And so part of the trip that Jake Sullivan and I took to Brazil and Argentina was to have some of these conversations about how you can find a way to deploy O-RAN at scale as something that gives Latin America and the Caribbean tools to develop its own domestic industries. Places like Brazil have very strong software industries, and if they were the embryo of 5G in Latin America, they wouldn't need Nokia, Ericsson, or Huawei. They would be developing their own 5G infrastructure, and that to us advances our interest. But to your question is,
let me just interrupt you for a second there. So let me just connect the dots on this for a second. Are you saying that the U.S. is providing or offering some kind of support, whether it be financial or technological, so that these governments, these countries, Brazil, Argentina, and so on, can develop their own national alternative on 5G and therefore not contract Huawei as the provider of those services?
We are actively promoting open radio access networks as a tool for Latin America and the Caribbean to develop its own 5G infrastructure. In some cases, we're offering technical assistance, but it's not something that we're going to fund. It's one where there are economic actors in these countries that could deploy this technology. Telecoms don't do it because they operate on such small margins. You actually need somebody that is, you need capital that is willing to deploy and compete to actually win auctions in these countries, and then deploy that technology infrastructure. And as that is deployed, particularly potentially in places like Brazil and Argentina and Colombia, you start creating market trends that are favorable to Latin America's economic interests. They won't depend on the U.S., they won't depend on China, they won't depend on anybody, because they'll be developing their own industry. But of course, I mean, the way that China approaches some of these issues is frankly in a very non-transparent way. And so, you know, the Blue Dot Network, which is something that is part of the G7 conversations that we're trying to really promote, making sure that there are certain standards when countries are having auctions, is part of this conversation, overall conversation on the role of China. And I'll tell you, when I was in Uruguay in May, you know, one of two most consolidated democracies along with Chile in the hemisphere, we're never going to out-trade China in Uruguay. I think it would not be really strategic for us to try. It's just not how their economy is structured geographically. It's not how they're structured. But they love their democracy. It is something that they do not want to abandon. And so countries like Uruguay and others are ready to have this conversation because they're starting to see the negative externalities associated with Chinese engagement, that it's not just economic, that there's some very negative elements to that. And they want to create a rules of the game for when countries are, you know, playing an influential role or looking to project and expand their relationships in the region. Going back to the vaccine question, I think it's the perfect contrast between what China has been doing and what the United States has been doing. And I think where the United States has an incredible comparative advantage in the Western Hemisphere. When China started sharing vaccines with the region, it had this vaccine predatory diplomacy, where they were trying to secure political agreements and pressure governments to switch recognition from Taiwan. And, you know, Haiti, they've refused to share, countries that didn't recognize China were basically ignoring them. That has built resentment in Latin America and the Caribbean. We maybe were late out of the gate when it came to vaccines, but made a very clear and concerted decision that if we were going to share vaccines, we were going to share them with governments of the left and governments of the right. We were not going to ask for anything in return, and we were going to let the public health professionals make the decision, so that the message from us would be very clear that we were doing this because it was in our national security interest to advance the public health needs of the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean. That's a segue to the preparations, and I can go into this if you'd like, or circle back to it. Is a lot of that approach is informing the planning that we are undertaking for the Summit of the Americas, which we are going to host next year, which is right now we're focused on the vaccine donation element, but we really should be thinking about expanding manufacturing production capabilities so that the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean aren't depending on external inputs to be able to manufacture. And it's in our interest to support Latin America's ability to do that so that when the next pandemic comes along, or if this one has variants that come and go, some are saying into 2024, we're going to be dealing with variants, that that the region is self-sufficient and is able to respond to the impact of the pandemic.
Juan, in the time that we've got together still, I want to do kind of a lightning round so we can touch on a couple different places and a couple different topics. Let's talk about Brazil. You know, as I recently wrote in the Brazilian magazine Piauí, the relationship between Washington and Brasilia has been a mixed picture. You know, on the one hand, we're 8 months into the administration and President Biden has spoken with a lot of global leaders, but not President Bolsonaro yet. On the other hand, you know, the relationship continues in areas like security cooperation, military to military cooperation, and so on. And as you mentioned, you were just in Brasilia with the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, and with Ricardo Zuniga, where you met with President Bolsonaro. How did that meeting go? What can you tell us about it? And you know, how would you define the relationship with Brazil overall?
So I did read your article. I'm not going to speak to the particulars of the conversation with Bolsonaro, but I'll say that Jake Sullivan is widely known as probably the smartest progressive mind in democratic politics right now, understands very well the importance of Brazil. I worked for him when then Vice President Biden essentially led diplomatic efforts to rebuild the relationship after the Snowden disclosures that led to the canceling of the state visit. And I think the basic premise is that regardless of who is the president of Brazil, Brazil matters. And Brazil is going to continuously increase in importance globally, and that we need to engage them at the government level, at the state level. Jake met with governors of Amazon states, at the private sector level, and keep moving that relationship in a direction where the United States and Brazil are increasingly collaborating. So for us, climate is central. And you know, in the last time we talked at the last podcast, we talked about a climate being as a gateway to a broader relationship, because we're not segregating climate and economic cooperation. But we also have strategic interests on the mill side. Daniel Erickson, who's the DASD for the Western Hemisphere, has been engaging with the Brazilians on that very actively. We on the technology front, on the democracy front, and a whole host of issues, Brazil matters. And so it is in our interest to engage with Brazil. We may not always agree with the government. We didn't agree with everything with Lula and with Rousseff. But you can't ignore Brazil, we have to start treating countries like Brazil like we do India and other rising economies, rather than try to put them in a penalty box whenever they don't align with our interests. So, I mean, that's the bottom line. But Brazil is maybe the largest economy in South America, with the two largest, you know, democracies in the region. But Brazil also matters. And so engaging with Brazil and Argentina, trying to rebuild the relationship that we had before 2002 has been something that we've invested a lot of time and effort into. And frankly, the bank shot on Brazil is engaging other governments and countries that touch the Amazon, because, you know, as I mentioned, for the president, the climate agenda is something that is a urgent national security issue. Last point is, you know, some argue that we have to have a choice, a binary between climate and China agenda, and that some, particularly the right in Brazil, are trying to use China as a get out of jail free card on questions of broader engagement and matters of governance. We don't subscribe to those binaries. I think these are complex and sophisticated relationships, and you know, we're going to seek to engage with Brazil across the board.
Before moving on to Argentina, let me just ask one more question about Brazil. On the specific question of potential democratic backsliding in Brazil, you were there just a couple of weeks ago. That same day, there was an escalation in Bolsonaro's confrontation with the other institutional powers. You know, he has talked about potentially even canceling next year's elections, which he can't really do in practice, but it kind of shows his intentions. Many have drawn parallels between him and the anti-democratic behavior of Donald Trump in the United States at the end of 2020. Is there a pain threshold for the United States in terms of, you know, at what point does it start criticizing what's happening in Brazil and it begins to affect the broader relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, I got to start by saying that we have confidence in Brazil's institutions. I think Brazilian democracy has a lot to teach even the countries of Europe about democracy. From our own experience, you recall during the campaign and then since the January 20th inauguration, Biden and Harris have been adamant about the needs to establish voter protections and voter rights to make sure that everybody has the right to vote. So questions about making sure that the machines are transparent and working. You know, I think those are conversations that are important for Brazilians to have. That's one route where we were very enthusiastic to support Brazil in any way. Then there's the other route, which is questioning outright an election or the robustness of the electoral process. That to us has parallels with the events of January 6th in this country. And that's not something that we can associate ourselves with. And whether it's Brazil or Colombia or Mexico or, you know, or even the United States, we're gonna speak out on it. But again, it's not a binary. And Brazil is an incredibly relevant and important country in so many ways that we are going to engage the government, we're going to engage the civil society, we're going to engage the private sector, because Brazil is incredibly important, not just in terms of regional engagement, but in terms of conversations with the United Nations, the G20, and entire global agenda. Countries like Brazil are only going to grow in importance.
So speaking of that trip south, it looks like a pretty good relationship between the administration and Argentina, which I have to say nobody really saw coming. You mentioned trying to restore that relationship back to the way it was prior to 2002, which was, you know, the crisis that Argentina went through. I was living in Buenos Aires during those years. I saw how that, you know, very Washington skeptical, let's say, philosophy took hold, and there have been ups and downs since then, but I do think it's right to identify that as kind of a turning point. Talk to me about where the common ground has been in that relationship and why Argentina seems important as a democratic partner.
First I got to give a lot of credit to Ambassador Jorge Arguello, who's just an incredible partner to work with. But when we came in January, we knew that given the crises the region was facing, we could not divide the region into those who were with us and those who were against us. And so we've sought common ground with all democratically elected governments. And in Argentina, for those who recall, the United States and Argentina had excellent relationship on matters of human rights, non-proliferation, became a major non-NATO ally. And so we sought to reach out to them and figure out if we could slowly but surely put together the bricks of that relationship back together. And they've been incredibly responsive, and leading with the conversation on climate. A lot of it, I think, from their, I think, political calculus has to do with the IMF loan, which is the largest in the IMF's portfolio. And from our perspective as well, we saw that engaging constructively with Argentina and even having conversations about its negotiations with the IMF and with other creditors had significance in two parts. Number one is that really the IMF was the only thing keeping Argentina in the West, and that number two, how Argentina resolved its relationship with the IMF would send a powerful signal to emerging markets that themselves are going through a very troublesome economic crisis. And so the the basic construct on that conversation was, let's engage at a senior level and let's have clear-eyed conversations and constructive conversations with the Argentines on these issues. Secretary Yellen spoke with Minister Guzman. Jake has talked to his counterparts. We've been engaging actively to try to not just develop a constructive bilateral relationship with Argentina, but also to help facilitate this dialogue with the IMF. And some of these are ones that we, a G7 country, maybe see it from one way, but if you look at the G7 70 countries, they see the impacts of the pandemic and its economic kind of ramifications potentially in a very different way. And we have to be willing to engage in these conversations to ensure that our Bretton Woods institution are able to adapt to the current crises.
Final question for you, Juan, and it's a philosophical one. We've talked about a lot of, challenges facing the region over the course of our conversation today. And let's be clear, I mean, there's a lot. On the other hand, you could make a somewhat optimistic case at this point that maybe the worst is behind us in terms of this tumult that has shaken the region over really the West as a whole over the last year and a half or so. I mean, for one thing, the economic recovery has been stronger than expected. CELAC, the UN body, now sees economic growth regionally of 5.9% in 2021. That would gain back most, not quite all, but most of what was lost last year, that 7% decline. There's great diversity within that number. Of course, some countries in the region are doing better than others. But COVID cases have also been trending down in several countries, including Brazil, Chile, and others, as vaccine progress continues. And I've also noticed, as we get more distant from kind of the worst moments of the pandemic, some of this anti-establishment and in some cases anti-democratic sentiment that we've seen across the region also seems to be ebbing a bit, just because people are in some places less angry than they were very justifiably in a lot of cases, say 6 months ago. As you look around the region right now, I mean, do you share some of that optimism and where do you, in sort of the broadest sense, where do you see the region heading over the next 2-3 years or so?
Well, I'll tell you, I wish I could end on a positive note, but I'm actually the most pessimistic on the region that I've ever been. And that is because the structural weaknesses of the region remain. Even as the pandemic, we turn the corner of the pandemic, the demographic trends in Latin America are not good. The dependence on fossil fuels, the issues of inequality, lack of investment really in gender, the lack of a coherent climate agenda in most countries, all of this are things that, again, Latin America has time to address these issues, but not a lot of time. And this gives me an opportunity to talk about the Summit of the Americas. Is when we're actually hosting, I mean, not only is the region in disarray, we're hosting all these leaders next year. What do we want this conversation to be about, particularly if it's the first summit the United States is hosting since 1994 when we launched it, and Bill Clinton launched it in Miami. And for us, it's about addressing issues that respond to the needs of the region. And there's incredible overlap with the president's domestic agenda and the summit agenda. The first was, we really need to have a coherent pandemic response for the region that goes beyond vaccinations, the donation of vaccines. Number two, we need to develop a migration policy or Western Hemisphere migration policy that recognizes that we have a migration system that really is built to receive, designed after World War II to receive European migrants and to apprehend, detain, and deport Mexican males. We need to think of a new approach that also creates legal pathways and is one that is done in coordination with the countries of the region. Build Back Better World, the president has made very clear that Latin America is going to be a focus area of that initiative, make sure that DFC and all our economic tools are used to try to promote an equitable and green recovery. The impact on Latin America from the pandemic can't just go back to the technologies of the past. But we also need to make sure that democracy delivers. That's the most important thing. This week was the 20th anniversary of the American Democratic Charter. this is a consensus in favor of democracy that we need to maintain. But for that, we need to make sure that the democracies are delivering for the needs of the region.
Juan Gonzalez, you know, it's such a big job. There's so much going on. I admire what you do. And you know, I know it's hard to balance all that and have a young, beautiful young family at home, too. So thank you so much for being on the AQ podcast today. I really appreciate your willingness to really unpack some of these very challenging issues.
My pleasure. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly podcast. You can read more at americasquarterly.org. Finally, if you enjoyed the episode, please give us a review, leave us a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. The America's Quarterly podcast is produced by Brendan O'Boyle and Gabrielle Cohen. America's Quarterly is an independent, not-for-profit publication of America's Society and the Council of the Americas.